Welcome to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films, every Friday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Pacific and online at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Kaspar. Documentary filmmaker Friedrich Moser, known for such work as A Good American, returns with a frightening and surprisingly hopeful documentary film called How to Build a Truth Engine, about the pervasive influence of disinformation and conspiracy theories that have reached levels unwitnessed since the turmoil of the 1930s. How to Build a Truth Engine portrays a crack team of investigators from the fields of technology, journalism, folklore, and neuroscience who show that if you hack the information feed, you can hack somebody's mind. The film How to Build a Truth Engine is premiering at this year's South by Southwest Film Festival beginning on Saturday, March 9th. Be looking for this if you're in town for this. Be looking for it anywhere it comes out because it's a wonderful documentary film. We're joined today by the director, and that would be Friedrich or Fritz Moser. Fritz, welcome to Film School Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. I cannot tell you how much not only did I enjoy the film for the documentary filmmaking, but the way in which this story unfolds and how it unfolds and the emphasis on things that were unexpected to me, the emphasis on science. And let's talk a little bit about the evolution of this story, why you were interested in telling this story to begin with, and how the telling of the story unfolds.
This actually goes back to another film that I did in 2015. Which I actually had on your show, which was called A Good American, and which was basically about the prequel story to the Edward Snowden story. And that film got me into the domain of national security, of software development. A spin-off of that film was a TV documentary that I did for a German-French broadcaster, where I followed a Vienna-based startup developing an open source intelligence surveillance tool to discover and monitor in the public discourse space the support network of the Islamic State in Europe. So back then, between 2015 and 2017, we had a wave of terrorist attacks in Europe, starting with Bataclan in France and then going all the way to Berlin and Manchester. And from that film, I stayed in touch with the guys who developed that software. And in 2018, one of the computer scientists told me that they had been asked if their software tool, which was basically graphing relationships between actors in the real world based on metadata, if their software tool could also be used to monitor disinformation and disinformation campaigns. It could not, because it was not going after content, but after the people behind the content. But one of these engineers then started to develop a software that would be actually able to do that, to find fake news in an automated way and to maybe put corrections to the false information where it was found. We got started with this film in early 2019. And first, it actually was a very small project. It was a project aimed at the Austrian market, which is a small country of 9 million people. You know? So That's like the size of New York City. So that's really small. And with an American leg to it, because I wanted to have the reporting of this investigative reporting that the New York Times Visual Investigations Unit is doing. I wanted to have that in the film as well, because they are using a lot of technology. And one of the members of that team is Austrian. So this was my way into there. Then in 2020, the pandemic happened and our main character, this software engineer, died from a heart attack. We don't know if it was related to COVID or not, but he died. And I was there with a half-finished film that basically had lost its main protagonist. So then I started to look for a new story. And I found this new story in America. I found it in California, where Tim Tangalini from UC Berkeley, who is working in the film of like narrative theory, he himself actually calls him, he actually calls himself a computational folklorist. So he comes from the field of folklore, but what he has been doing for a long time is like big data analysis of that folklore. And he, while working at UCLA in the 2000s and in the 2010 years, he teamed up with Vani Rajchowdhury, another professor who is a computer scientist and who had been working towards analyzing narratives from a totally different angle. So the two teamed up and they came up with a software tool that was called StoryMiner, and which manages to extract the relationship between the actors and the actants. So the actors is clear, but the actants are like places and ideas and things in a story, and graph the relationship between them. And from graphing that relationship of these actors and actants, you can see if the connections between different layers of stories are strong or weak. And if they are weak, there's a high probability that they have been stitched together artificially. And this is how you can actually discover conspiracy theories, not by the content, but by the narrative structure. And so, and that of course, I was like blown away when I discovered this, and I asked them, okay, can I make a film about this? And they said, yeah, you can, but you have to talk to these guys from the neuroscience department at UCLA, Sarah Agarjan and Itzhak Fried, because they are doing very important research on how information is actually being processed in the brain, how we are digesting information. And they are doing it down to a level of individual neurons that they can observe how they react to certain input. So this is how all these different stories came together. So it started with how to fight disinformation from a technological perspective and from investigative journalism. And then this neuroscientific part came into it. And I think, without disregard to the technologists and the journalists, I find the neuroscientific part the most interesting one, because I don't know of any other film that is bringing that into play when we talk about disinformation and when we talk about conspiracy theories and when we look at things like QAnon or, you know, whatever is out there.
And it is so strong. That's such a powerful part of this film. One thing I want to bring into the conversation, which is that there's a reference in the film to a very famous book called The Art of War, written by a Chinese general or military strategist, Sun Tzu, who said the best way to win a war is to not fight the war, which, if taken into a modern context, is to create confusion and disunity to the point where your enemy collapses. I think I have that right.
Exactly. By creating confusion in the camp of the enemy. And I think this is really what information warfare is about.
Yeah.
And we had long discussions internally whether we should put that focus or not. So we had versions. So the version actually that I submitted to South by Southwest, which was like the first rough cut that we had, didn't have that perspective on it. But we thought that somehow it was very hard to get into why do we have these scientific explanations without having this focus of information warfare prior to it, leading up to it. And so then we decided to bring it back in, because we had it in previous versions of the film. And I think it is something that we need to take very serious. It's nothing new. You know, information warfare propaganda has happened as long as people probably communicate to each other, or different tribes communicate against each other. So I don't think that this is something new. But what is new, and this is where all the brain science comes into play, is the amount of information that we are confronted with now in the digital age, and also the velocity of how algorithms are playing us. And they are almost a billion times faster now than the reaction time of our brain.
Yeah.
So this, of course, has a huge influence of how easily we can be manipulated.
Going back to the very earliest days of human behavior, human civilization, the attempt on the part of one group to dehumanize another group is as old as, I'm sure, as long as we've been organizing ourselves into some kind of cohesive unit, we have been doing those kinds of things. But absolutely, what you're saying now about today is that it's a whole new assault on our brains, on our ability to understand the world, given the technology that is now available to us. This is something that's new to our brain, let alone to the world, to understand how these things are happening to us and why. And you get down, like you said, into the neurological science of all this. And it's so important to understand this, because if you're feeling overwhelmed, if you're feeling like you can't know what the truth is, there's a reason for that. There's a reason for you to feel that way. And to that point, there's a well-known Vladimir Putin advisor, I believe his name is Serkov, who purportedly said something that is so relevant to the world we currently live in, and that is, in this new world, nothing is real and anything is possible. In terms of cyber warfare, that is the overriding guiding principle of what we're talking about. Very quickly, I want to remind our listeners that we're speaking with Friedrich, or Fritz, Moser. He is the director of a wonderful documentary film called How to Build a Truth Engine. It is premiering at the South by Southwest Film Festival and on Saturday, March 9th. So be looking for this wonderful documentary film. But you, along the way, in the telling of this story, and let's be guardedly optimistic about all this, How to Build a Truth Engine, is you're giving us a way forward. As we go through the film, let's talk about just how you went about finding these pieces to put together to give us this sense that it's not lost.
Well, first of all, currently, really, literally, in the past weeks, there has this huge criticism of the New York Times has emerged in social media and on social media for its reporting about the American run up to the American elections and how they're portraying Joe Biden and Donald Trump. But what I have to say is, within the New York Times, it's a huge organization. Within the New York Times, there's this unit which is called Visual Investigations. Yes. That was brought to life around 2016, 2017. And what they are doing is next level journalism. Yes. They are doing investigative journalism in a totally different way as how we have seen it in films and as how we imagine it very, very likely and probably, by using a lot of technology, by also using this vast amount of information that's already out there. Yeah. Organizing it, vetting it, trying to find the evidence in all this visual material that is already there. And what is striking is, you know, during all the time that they've put out reports, they never had to retract one, because this is all about accuracy. This is all about the minuscule detail. And at the same time, their reporting is being used as a base to prosecute crimes against humanity at the International Criminal Court. And this is something that where they proved stuff that happened during the civil war in Syria, and this happened again with the war of Russia against Ukraine. And you will see these cases in the film. I mean, everybody can watch these videos because they are online on their YouTube channel and they're online at the website of the New York Times. But what I did and what they let me do, I have to say, is really observe them and watch them as they are working with the material and on the material and capture all the reasoning behind it. And I think that's the kind of journalism that's going to expand massively in the coming years to many, many newsrooms. And as technology gets cheaper, also the way of doing this kind of journalism is going to become much more ubiquitous than what it is now. But I've already seen in the past year that now the Washington Post has created a similar unit. The Associated Press is using similar technologies. The BBC is using similar technologies. One of the early adopters of these technologies was Bellingcat, which is a research, like an independent research and investigative group based in the UK and the Netherlands.
And pardon me for interrupting. And I believe we're very helpful in tracking down the people who poisoned Navalny.
Yes. And so I think these And for me, it was, of course, brilliant to watch this. I mean, basically, Christoph Köttl, the Austrian guy in this within this team of the New York Times, his domain is working with satellite images. And whenever there's a conflict, now they have got this deal with Planet Labs. That's a satellite manufacturer and operator based out of San Francisco. He's able to actually steer the satellite, I don't know how many times, like 3 or 5 times a month, to position it where he wants from his laptop. Just think about that. I mean, this would have been totally impossible 10 years ago. And I think that's the kind of advance in technology that's very helpful to have greater accountability in the future and also in the present.
No, and also the NASA engineers who came to the front here and said, hey, let's put our iPhones in space and see if we can make that work as a satellite. And I'm without giving too much away, it's a remarkable story, and it's a remarkable testament to the ingenuity of people when they put their minds and their hearts behind something that they feel so strongly about. And I kind of leapfrogged right over the idea that it's very prominent in the film. The journalism has been under attack for forever. I mean, people have been trying to knock down real journalism for a long, long time. But now we live in an age where the financial viability of good journalism is at stake. And what you're describing is finding a way around that with StoryMinder and Truthful and some of these other things that are in the film. So you want to talk a little bit about the importance of journalism, but also we need to support it.
Absolutely. I'm following a lot of journalists on social media, obviously, because I'm interested in their perspectives. And there is much talk about that the traditional media is dying because advertisement is not paying anymore. But on the other side, there are so many podcasters and so many independent journalists who are now sort of teaming up to create bottom-up organizations instead of the traditional top-down organizations to do the news. And I think journalism is going to die when there is no hunger anymore from ordinary people for news. And I don't see this coming. So I think we are in a transitional period where traditional journalism, as we had known it, is adapting itself to the new technological realities of the 21st century. I think this is what's needed. And I think it's a transitional period, and there will be revenues again because people want to know the truth. And the reason for that is our society, be it in the economic space, be it also in the social space and cultural space, is transactional. You only can have a transaction going on when you know that what you are agreeing about is true. So if you're buying a good or services, you expect them to be real. So that's like the base of it. The same goes for democracy. Also, democracy is transactional. So we need to know what's true or not so that we can make compromises or have our conflicts or whatever, but at the end of the day, make our compromises on how to move forward. This is what democracy is about. Democracy is about people having different ideas and people having different strategies of moving forward. And they need to find a way to do this together. And the same is also true for cultural issues. So if we lose a grip of the truth, and this is a quote that I have from Peter Cochrane, who used to be a technology leader in the UK, introducing AI early on into British Telecom, and has then worked as a consultant for a long time, and is now teaching sentient systems. So that's basically AI applications at a university in the UK. So what he says is, if we lose our grip on the truth, we lose our civilization, and I totally second that. I think this is what is at stake. And this is why it's so important to not let fake news and conspiracy theories win this war on truth, which actually is a war within our minds.
Yes.
And that's the really new thing.
Yes.
Digital technology made it possible that we became the battlefield of a war that's ongoing, and every one of us, And I think it's not helpful to show with, you know, to point with the finger at one group or the other. Everybody is vulnerable, everybody, including us as we are talking here. Because the thing is, the way the brain works, and this is being explained in the film, the way the brain works is we are learning by seeing the consequence or feeling the consequences of our actions. So if there are no consequences to our actions online, we degenerate. And that's exactly what you can see. The way people communicate online is a way they would never communicate face to face. And so I think what we really need to do here is kind of go back to some of the old ways and face-to-face communication, and we'll see and recognize the other as a human being, as a mirror of yourself, just with different beliefs and maybe different opinions and maybe a different agenda. But at the end of the day, we are all humans. And I think that's the kind of way to move forward. So the truth engine in the title is never fully explained. But what it actually is a mix of things. It's, on one hand, it's journalism really brought up to 21st century, incarnation of it. Then the second thing is technology to help us stay clear in this flood of information that we're exposed to. And the third thing is education. We need to know that we are all vulnerable, all of us, everybody. And then we can start working towards how do we become resilient? How do we become more aware of the fact that we can be manipulated and very likely are manipulated? And once that happens, I think there is a good chance that we come out of this media transition in which we're in a not totally harmful way. Because these kind of changes in communication and in the media ecosystem have happened before. And it has happened when the printing press was invented. And as one of the outcomes, you had revolutions all over Europe, and revolts and civil wars. Then when the newspapers were invented, like in the 1700s, leading up to the French Revolution, and pamphlets and all this, you know, making printing cheap and available to everybody, you had the next wave of revolutions. And now we are at the verge of the digital age. And do we want to see another wave of revolutions that end up in bloodbaths? I'm a historian, a trained historian. I say, no, I actually don't want to see this.
Absolutely. Thank you. Well said. Thank you so much. You know, in the U.S. Constitution, the only business that's mentioned is the press, is the media, is our ability to have access to the free flow of information. It was important enough to the founding fathers, as they say, to put that in the Constitution, to embed that in our rights as citizens. And we are in the same kind of struggle today as they were in the 1776 and 1892 when we became a republic. Well, thank you for this film again, How to Build a Truth Engine. It is premiering at the South by Southwest Film Festival March 9th, this coming Saturday. Be looking for it. And I just can't thank you enough. It's just an absolutely wonderful film, document, story, and it couldn't come at a better time. Friedrich Fritz Moser, thank you so very much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mike.
You've been listening to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films. You can find out more about the program at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Kaspar. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next week with another edition of Film School Radio.